This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Indiana's 2020 legislative session is in the books. Today, we'll look at what passed, what didn't, and why. And a quick note, today's show is pre-recorded, so we unfortunately cannot get your questions and comments onto the show, but we would always love to hear what you think. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. And joining me now are two reporters who spend a lot of time at the State House throughout the year, not just during the session. Brandon Smith is our State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Thanks for joining us, Brandon.
Always happy to be here.
And we also have reporter Nikki Kelly, who covers state government and politics for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. Thank you for stopping by, Nikki.
Thanks for having me.
So we've got to hit the coronavirus right off the top because this came about at the tail end of the session, which is now a week past or so. Did that come into play whatsoever at the end of the session?
You know, on the last night of session was when things sort of started kind of exploding nationally. So it was certainly as everyone was doing their bills and trying to get done on the last night. Everyone was checking their phone and becoming more and more nervous. But other than, you know, I know we talked to a couple of the leaders to see if there was anything that the lawmakers needed to do before they left town. And everyone said, no, we think we're good. The governor has authority to move money around if he, you know, has to spend from the surplus, stuff like that. So the session sort of ended, you know, without any big coronavirus stuff. And then they left town.
Yeah, the question will be because so much has changed, so much is changing so fast. The answers that they gave a week ago, which is no, we talked to the governor. He's assured us that he has all the authority that he needs, and we don't think we need to do anything. That might be different. That might be different than some of their answers today. And so there is always the possibility that they will have to be called into a special session of some sort to pass any sort of emergency legislation to help with some of the issues that are cropping up around coronavirus. But as of right now, we haven't seen that. And we should emphasize that when we talk about the broad powers that the governor has, they are really broad powers. And these were passed in the wake, I think, of 9/11. When an emergency is declared of this magnitude, so in this case a pandemic, a health emergency, the governor, I mean, the statutory authority of the governor has to do a lot of stuff, including what we've already seen, close businesses, things like that. He can stop people driving on the roads if he needs to. Now, we don't think we'll see that, but the governor in the state of Indiana was given really broad powers about 20 years ago, or a little less than 20 years ago. And they also gave a lot of powers to, when Mitch Daniels was governor, to move money around. So whether that's spending the state surplus on various needs to keep the government running as tax revenue starts to dry up here probably in the next couple of months, the governor has a lot of authority to do things without needing the legislature's approval.
Nikki, he said he doesn't think that the governor will go so far as to keep people off the roads, but things change so fast. Do you share the same feeling?
Look, I have no idea. We are going through something none of us have ever seen. I couldn't have imagined a week ago ordering all bars and restaurants to close, partially because, I mean, let's face it, people weren't paying attention to these rules and guidance that CDC and health officials were giving, and they're just still going out and hanging out with their friends and, you know, not really caring. And so he had to take that next step. So I have no idea what the next couple of weeks will come from. I am, you know, hanging on one day at a time to see the governor's going to talk to us this afternoon, and we'll see what he says then.
Amazing what changes in a week. So if the Indiana General Assembly were to be called back, I mean, at this point, the governor can do an awful lot. Why would he need them?
So Democratic candidate for governor Woody Myers this week, who is a former state health commissioner. He's a medical doctor. He's worked in the healthcare industry pretty much his entire career. So more than just a candidate for governor, he also has expertise in this area, called earlier this week, he said that the General Assembly should come back for a special session to do some things that the governor can't do. One would be possibly expanding unemployment benefits, so making it the eligibility for that a little broader. We've seen reports, maybe unconfirmed reports, but we've seen anecdotal reports so far that some people are saying that they are applying for unemployment benefits, not just here in Indiana but elsewhere, applying for unemployment benefits, and when the government goes to their employer and says, hey, we're just checking this person is now unemployed, right? oh, no, they're not laid off. We've just zeroed out their hours. So they're still an employee, but we're not paying them any money and we're not giving them any work. Well, do we need to adjust laws to address that situation? So that's something that I'm not sure the governor could do with his broad statutory authority. Something else like passing a paid sick leave bill. That's definitely something the governor can't do on his own. And Woody Myers thinks the General Assembly should come in and do that. So there are a few things that theoretically they would – well, that they would probably need legislative authority to do. Whether or not the governor and legislative leaders feel that requires them to come into a special session is an unresolved question.
And also just to point out, maybe the governor can do those, maybe he can't. But there is a point when, as governor, you want to know you have the support and you want the citizenry to know this isn't a one-person sort of dictatorship that, you know, maybe he wants the lawmakers to come in to pass a new price gouging law or to expand unemployment, those kinds of things, because he wants them all to know this isn't just me. This is your representative government telling you this is what we need to do right
because
now.
Because we have seen this week a couple of members of the General Assembly. Now, the caveat here is these are maybe the most conservative members of the General Assembly and, generally speaking, quite frankly, lawmakers that don't really influence the General Assembly in a dramatic way. But we've seen a couple lawmakers say, well, the governor doesn't have an authority to shut down bars and restaurants. You know, that the government is overreaching here. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but I think that, you know, the governor has a lot of lawyers working for him. I'm pretty sure he wouldn't have done this if he didn't think he could. And it appears that, again, as we talked about, he has that statutory authority. But to Nikki's point, it would really help him for other things that where that gets a little more questionable about what where how far his authority extends. Having the General Assembly give that a rubber stamp would go a long way towards, I mean, just sort of making sure our democracy is still working the way it's supposed to.
Although, interestingly, I mean, we, you know, kind of laugh about it, but, you know, can you get 150 members of the lawmakers in one building? Is that, you know, recommended health-wise? Clearly
right.
Not, you know.
Right. And that's just the lawmakers. Then you have staff who need to make the place run. So now we're bringing into question, you know, remote vote. Can you remote, you know, or can you vote remotely? Can you vote, you know, over Skype or something like that? So even physically, the act of getting them into a special session becomes a questionable proposition.
We have State House reporters Brandon Smith from Indiana Public Broadcasting and Nikki Kelly from the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette here talking about the 2020 legislative session, although the biggest news stories right now, of course, is COVID-19 and its spread and the economic turmoil that we're kind of in as a result. And, of course, I want to get to the session, but I've got one more thing. So if the General Assembly were to come together, I've heard the biggest criticism of the federal response to the economy tanking at the moment is the fact that one of Trump's biggest ideas is a payroll tax deduction, which does nothing for the gig economy. Could something be done at the state level to help in that way?
Probably. Without being well-versed in Indiana tax law, it doesn't feel like the state government can do a lot of the things that people are hoping and wanting the federal government to do. Mm. And a big part of that is because, for instance, the stimulus package that they've already passed in Congress and the further stimulus packages that they're discussing passing in the next week or 2 weeks or whatever it is, require you to take on a lot of debt. I mean, they're just adding and adding and adding to the national debt. But they can do that. Mm. You cannot do that at the state level. You cannot – I mean, literally, constitutionally, you are not allowed to pass a law that creates debt except for in extreme emergencies. And even then, there really isn't much of a mechanism for it.
Now, we have balanced budget rules in Indiana that the federal government just doesn't have. So when people hear that Indiana has a $2 billion surplus, I think it's important for them to realize that is not there for us to send checks to everyone to stimulate the economy. That's more the federal governments. That is there to literally make sure we still have police on the roads and, you know, that we can keep state government going and the things that people need when tax dollars dry up, because they are going to dry up.
Yeah. I use the example of unemployment benefits. So Indiana has an unemployment insurance trust fund that will pay people unemployment. It will probably need to be expanded. We get money from the federal government, like every state or almost every state does, in the time of a recession like we're probably about to hit. But we literally need to keep that program running. So there are state employees required to make sure those payments are being processed, to process new claims and things like that. Well, those people need to be paid, and the way you do that is you use the surplus. It is called a rainy day fund by a lot of folks, and this is exactly what it's for. It's when the tax revenue dries up, we need to keep parts of state government running, and that's what that $2 billion
is
for.
It's not to keep the economy going. It's to keep the state government going.
Yeah.
That's why a lot of people are thankful for the surplus and thankful that it's there. So, Brandon, let's get to the session. You've described it on multiple occasions as a weird session.
I sure did.
Nikki, do you agree?
Yeah, it was sort of hurry up and wait. And in the end, you know, you can point to two or three or four things that were sort of, I call, tinkering around the edges. You know, it's not that they were bad, but they were also not big deals or things that are going to make major changes for Hoosiers' lives. So, I agree with weird.
Are you comfortable sharing examples of that, exactly that?
Well, I mean, here's an example of something that I think some of the healthcare stuff that the lawmakers put together, they came in saying we're going to really look at healthcare costs, and they passed some sort of minor things that give transparency on billing and prices of healthcare services, but they don't do anything in and of themselves to reduce those costs. So that's an example. Okay, great. I can now look up what a knee replacement in, you know, Northeast Indiana might look like, or I'm going to get a good faith estimate of what costs I can expect to pay when I have a procedure, but they don't actually lower those costs in any way.
And it's important to know that on a couple of those, they proposed some stuff and actually even advanced at times during the session some stuff that would have lowered healthcare costs. A great example is that good faith estimate. So this is an issue called surprise billing. So you go in for a knee replacement and your doctor's in network, your hospital's in network, you know, the surgeon and everything, but your anesthesiologist isn't. So a few weeks after you just had this knee replacement, I get a bill from an anesthesiologist that is way more than I thought I was going to get. Well, lawmakers looked at that situation and said, we have to fix that. There was a bill that said, you can't do that. So if that anesthesiologist is out of network, you can only charge that patient an in-network price if everything else was in network. They advanced that partway through the process, but what they ended up with was, as Nikki pointed out, they're just going to tell you about it beforehand.
We are spending the hour today recapping Indiana's 2020 legislative session, which ended last week. We will be back in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today, we're talking about Indiana's 2020 legislative session, which ended last week. We're in the studio with Brandon Smith, reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and Nikki Kelly, reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. Governor Holcomb signed the first bill of 2020 into law before the session had even hit the halfway point, which is rare. Was there a reason behind that? What did that particular bill do, Brandon?
I'm going to tell you what the bill did, and then we'll talk maybe a little bit about whether it's actually going to happen.
Okay.
To bring everything back to coronaviruses, as it seems like we are nowadays. So the last state budget ended last year, so last July, the state ended up with about $300 million more dollars than they were expecting. And rather than just put that in the surplus, they said, well, we want to spend that a little bit to help us out down the line. And so the bill that passed was going to take that $300 million and use it to pay cash for some higher education building projects around the state at various institutions. And the logic behind that is if you pay cash for it up front instead of taking out bonds to pay for it and pay those out over 20, 30 years – you will save yourself about $130-something million in interest payments over those 20 years. Now, what folks on the other side, generally Democrats, said is two things. One, well, we're going to be using these buildings for the next 30 to 50 years, so why shouldn't we pay for them over the next 20 to 30 years and use that money now to pay for things like teacher salary increases or pre-K education or lowering prescription drug costs? Republicans were adamant the whole time. They didn't want to do that. And so they passed it very fast. They said in order to help get the money to universities. But there was also a sentiment that, like, well, we don't want to keep having this debate over the course of an entire session. So if we just get it out of the way soon, we'll stop having that discussion. And for the most part, that's what happened. They stopped having that discussion.
Yeah, but I will say this. It was signed into law. It still requires that the state budget committee formally release that money. And there is a question now. I mean, is that $300 million we now need to hang on to? All those building projects were set to go forward with bonding regardless, so they could still do that.
Yeah, it's not like the building projects weren't going to happen if we didn't send this money
out. It was
out.
Just cash or bonding. It wasn't like you either get the building or you don't. So now I think there's a fair question to be had in this new world where we don't really understand how long this is going to go on, and where maybe that's $300 million we need to hold on to for other things.
Now, we asked that question to legislative leaders right as the session was ending last Wednesday. You know, should we hold on to that money now, even though we didn't think we had to? And at the time, they said, oh, no. We still want to save that money long term. We want to get those projects paid for in cash. But again, as we talked about right at the top of the show, I think their answers might be different today because so much has changed since we asked that question.
Exactly. It's more than 10% of the surplus. I mean, it's a good amount.
Yeah, $300 million is a good chunk of money. So, that's nothing to sneeze at.
Why didn't the House Public Policy Committee hold a single meeting this session, Nikki?
I think the reason on the record is that Representative Ben Smaltz, who heads that committee, just didn't see any bills that he thought were absolutely necessary. To be fair, public policy handles a lot of alcohol, gaming, firearms bills. And he said basically we had done a lot on alcohol. We just last year did this massive gambling overhaul. So he basically said, look, our area has had a lot of movement and we're just going to let it lie for a little bit. Now, there were some smaller bills that could have gone through affecting some charity gambling, things like that. But, I think he was just like, nope, we've done enough and we're going to take some time off to let some of these more controversial issues, lay low for a while.
Yeah, to me, that phrase that Nikki just used, controversial issues, is important here. House Public Policy deals with a lot of these really hot button, quote unquote, social issues that we talk about. And this is an election year, or at least it was when we were in the session. Who knows what's going to happen? This is a big election year. At the federal level, certainly, but at the state level as well. All 100 members of the House are up for re-election. Or up for 100 seats are up for election, half of the Senate, so 25 seats in the Senate. The governor is up for re-election this year. So this is a big year, and I think there's some sentiment among lawmakers, well, let's not rock the boat too much. And to be fair to Representative Smaltz, too, he is right. They have done a lot these last few years out of that public policy committee. So it's not as if something was really crying out for need.
Both chambers underwent a turnover of leadership over the last 14 months. What effect did that have?
You know, I didn't see a huge impact. Obviously, the Senate had already changed, and the big issue with the House was having Brian Bosma step down as Speaker, and Todd Houston was sort of Speaker-elect. So he was involved all session in all the discussions and behind the scenes meetings, and then he took over as Speaker with just a few days left in the session. I didn't see any massive differences in it. I think in general, some of the committees maybe were a little more out of control. It seemed like what kept happening is they would put forward a bill with sort of drastic changes and then Bosma would pull it back, and they'd put forward something else and Bosma would pull it back. And so there was a little bit of that this year.
Yeah. The thing I've heard from lobbyists in the hallway, folks who've worked at the General Assembly for a long time and have seen leadership changes and things like that, talked about this problem of what they called a disconnect between the leaders at the top of the chamber and the committee chairs, that the committee chairs were kind of just operating kind of on their own without a lot of direction. And the Senate leadership shift took place well over a year ago, but State Senate President Pro Tem Rod Bray is still learning on the job, as Todd Houston will now going forward. And I think there's a concern about sloppiness that the process wasn't as smooth as it sometimes need to be. And a lot of folks outside the State House might not necessarily care about the process too much, and I get that. But process does matter in some ways, because if you want to make good laws, having a bad process isn't usually conducive to that. So having a smooth process, having committee chairs all kind of on the same page, making sure that the legislation that's coming out of their committees is well drafted even. I mean,
that's one thing that both the House and Senate should really focus on for next year is some more self-discipline in the committee process, because I felt like the committee chairmen were like, oh, we only have two meetings. Well, we're going to hear all the same number of bills we would hear in four meetings, but we're going to do it in two. You know, we're going to limit testimony. We're going to take on the fly amendments. And it's just, you know, it's ripe for mistakes. And mistakes were all over bills this year and having to be fixed.
And the number of times I heard a committee chair go, well, we need to get this bill out and we'll fix it later on. Mm. And then there's questions about whether or not that would ever actually happen. So I think there were some issues with process, which, again, can be important to making good law.
Brandon, you had a quote from a lobbyist about this who said that there was a disconnect this session between leaders and committees.
Yeah. And I just sort of the thing that stuck out to me about what that lobbyist, Mike O'Brien, who's can be heard on this station and many others on Indiana Week in Review every week, at least for the foreseeable future. He pointed out that what we don't know, speaking of things we don't know about, is was this just because there is some new leaders and new blood and they have to get everything on the same page? Or is this just going to be the way it is? And we won't know that for a while, but it's certainly something to watch out for in the coming couple of sessions.
And I think it's also a little bit cyclical. We've had these Republican supermajorities for quite a while, and it seems like they were ever able to sort of restrain themselves for a number of years. And as both these leaders leave, there's a worry that, and I saw a little bit of it this year, you know, that they're just like, whatever, we'll just do what we want and not worry about it. And
well, and to that point, here's a great example. The current leaders of the House and Senate, Todd Houston and Rod Bray, have only ever served in the General Assembly under Republican supermajorities. They were both elected in 2012 and started serving in 2013, and they've only ever experienced supermajorities. So David Long has experienced Republican majorities his whole career, but Brian Bosma served in the minority for a lot of his career, quite frankly. And so he knows what it's like to be under more divided government, and these other leaders just don't.
And it's fair to say, you know, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do it. And I think they're struggling with the second part right now.
We are talking about the 2020 legislative session, wrapping it up with Brandon Smith from Indiana Public Broadcasting and Nikki Kelly from the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I guess, what were lawmakers focused on this session? Kind of, what were some of the big picture things, Nikki?
Well, we mentioned health care a little bit earlier. Both sides seem to say we're really going to look at health care.
It seemed like a lot of the big picture stuff were things that the governor brought up in the State of the State address. Those seemed to get a lot of news.
There was a lot of agreement on a lot of the big picture stuff, although, as Nikki pointed out right off the top, nothing was like earth shattering. Mm. Nothing is going to dramatically change Hoosiers' lives, with the possible exception, and we hope it will change people's lives, of something that I would argue actually wasn't on the legislative leaders' agendas, which was a big agenda item of the governor's, which is distracted driving. So he signed it into law yesterday, I think. So it'll take effect in July. But you can't use your cell phone in your hand while you're driving anymore. Phones down. You have to use the Bluetooth, but you can't be reading emails. You can't be texting people. You can't even be using your cell phone to call somebody if you're holding it in your hand. Now, I say we hope that will change people's lives, because that's the buzzword around that was culture shift, or buzzwords, I suppose. That's two words. Lawmakers really want people to change what they do in the car as a result of this law, because we've seen the dangers of – I mean, just drive around and take a glance at other people. I mean, just staring at their phones while they drive. Even lawmakers talked about it throughout the process, like – They were more conscious of what they did on the roadways, and they noticed the bad habits in themselves and were trying to fix them. So I think it's going to take time. That's not an immediate change, even when the law takes effect in July. But that'll be something that I think lawmakers hope does have a big impact on Hoosiers' lives in the long term.
And was there anything surprising that lawmakers did not get to?
Well, obviously, they had decided from day one not to deal with teacher pay, which teachers had really wanted them to address. But they said, no, this is not a budget year. We're not going to be focusing on that. So we saw that.
And I'll put on that list something that we didn't think they were going to do, then we thought they were going to do, and then they didn't do, which is address Curtis Hill situation. So Attorney General Curtis Hill is under he's going through a disciplinary process because he allegedly groped four women a couple years ago, and the outcome of that process is still unknown. That could happen in the next month or two, or we don't know for sure, but. What we do know is that on the table, a hearing officer's recommendation was a 60-day suspension of his law license without automatic reinstatement. What is unclear is what that would mean under state law as to his ability to continue being attorney general until his term ends at the end of this year, and then his ability to run for attorney general, which is he is currently trying to do. For the longest time, we didn't think the lawmakers were clear they didn't want to address that. They thought it was too political. It's in an election year. They didn't want to get into it. And then that hearing officer made her recommendation that put some like real numbers, a real idea around it. And things changed for a little while. Right, Nikki?
Yeah. House Republicans especially came out and said, basically, look, we shouldn't have an attorney general who doesn't have an active law license. State law does say that to run for attorney general, to take office, you have to have
You have to be duly licensed to practice law. And the
but
problem is we didn't know what that meant.
Absolutely silent on what would happen if during your term something happens to your license. So, I mean, there was a real legitimate question on whether he would be, you know, attorney general, whether governor had ability to appoint a new attorney general. And they, in the end, did not do it. Senate Republicans balked. So when or if he gets a suspension of any kind, we will be, you know, stuck in flux unless the Supreme Court clarifies whether he should remain in office.
And it'll be the Supreme Court who does come out with that final decision on what if any, penalty or punishment Curtis Hill should face. So lawmakers now are kind of hoping that they speak up and clarify exactly what they mean when they say, you know, let's say his license was suspended for 30 days. Well, what does that mean? They're hoping the Supreme Court will tell them. Otherwise, we could be looking at a real legal battle over Curtis Hill's ability to continue being attorney general.
Who was it that called it the biggest missed opportunity of the session? Was that Todd Houston?
It was. Speaker of the House, Todd Houston. That last night we asked I asked the legislative leaders what was the biggest missed opportunity this year, and he said it was that bill.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. And this not a budget year excuse is something that we've heard about a lot of things, not just teacher pay this year. Can you think of any other examples of things that were not addressed because it's not a budget year?
Anything fiscal is what it comes down to. If there's anything that will bring in money or spend money, generally, not just for this specific session, they hold those to every other year in the budget year.
As an example, as a notable example, we talked about the legislation that raises the smoking age from 18 to 21. That just brings us into compliance with federal law. Mm. It also doubles the fines for retailers who sell to those who are underage to hopefully try to bring the hammer down and make sure that the kids aren't getting as much access to these things. There are folks as part of that conversation who want to see us raise the cigarette tax or who want to see us tax vaping products at all beyond the normal sales tax, which we currently don't do. But the message from lawmakers is, well, that's taxes, that's more revenue, let's leave that until the budget session when we can look at sort of the whole picture.
Mm. And there was an abortion bill this session, but it sounds like that one was relatively uncontroversial.
Well, it basically, they passed a bill in 2016 that says when an abortion happens at a clinic or in a hospital, the clinic or the hospital has to bury or cremate the remains. That was challenged in the courts. That particular part of the bill was upheld by the Supreme Court last year. So this was, it was sort of codifying that. It was
establishing laying out the procedures
around that law that had already been upheld from the Supreme Court.
So they finally got the okay from the U.S. Supreme Court last summer. That, okay, this is okay. We can actually enforce this. But now it was, okay, well, how? Like, and some of this is literally like forms that the healthcare facility would have to fill out with the funeral home or whoever they're doing the burial or cremation with. So a lot, it was literally the procedures. But the reason I think it wasn't nearly as controversial as a lot of past abortion bills was, one, it's the primary issue here has already been litigated, literally, and debated years ago. And two, and this is something that the this year's bill's author, Republican Senator Liz Brown, emphasized over and over and over and over again, which was this does not impose any new requirements. It does not force a woman who is seeking an abortion to do anything. She will have to check a box on a form if she wants. So the healthcare facility, when she comes in for an abortion, has to say to her on one of the many forms that women are required in this state to sign before they have an abortion, she will just have to say, okay, well, we're going to have to either bury or cremate these fetal remains. Which one do you want? That's all the new things that a woman will have to do that she wasn't already required.
Despite the fact that opponents have tried, frankly, I think they've even been purposely misleading at times. They've brought up this idea that if you have a miscarriage at home or if you do a medication-assisted abortion, so you actually pass the remains at home, the bill does say you are allowed to bring those into the facility to have them buried or cremated, but it was made like a governmental mandate that you were going to have to carry these remains, you know, which obviously the bill does not do.
It absolutely does not do.
We will keep the conversation going after a quick break. We're talking today about the 2020 legislative session in Indiana, which came to an end last week, and a lot has changed since then. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our recap of Indiana's 2020 legislative session. We're joined again by Brandon Smith, Statehouse reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and Nikki Kelly, who covers state government and politics for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. Today's show was pre-recorded, so we cannot get your questions or comments on the air, but we would love to hear from you if you would like to speak with us. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana for your comments. And there was a bill involving a teacher gun training program that didn't make it through. What happened there, Brandon?
Yeah, so this is their second go-around of trying to do this. So right now under Indiana law, a teacher is allowed to carry a gun in the classroom in school if their local school board okays it. There is no requirement about any sort of training that that teacher or staff member would have to undergo before being allowed to do that. Now, very few school districts do it, and I believe all of the – I think it's only like five.
I think it's only three, and to their credit, they have all implemented their own training requirements.
Yes. So where we have teachers carrying in schools right now in Indiana, they are trained to do so. What the bill that made it through part of the session would have done, and they tried to do basically the same thing last year as well, and it didn't make it to the finish line, would say if you want to carry in school, regardless of, you know, even if your local school board okays it, you have to go through a fairly extensive amount of training. And I think that's what some people are balking at is, I mean, it was a certain number of hours of certainly gun training itself on the range in specific scenarios, learning how to deal with emergency medical situations, learning the legal ramifications of firearms and shootings and things like that, psychological testing. It's Senate Republicans who are pushing this, not all of them, but this bill has come out of the Senate Republican caucus these last two sessions. And the message they are putting forward is, okay, a vote against this bill is not a vote against guns in schools. A vote against this bill is a vote against trained teachers with guns in schools. They're arguing, we already had the debate over whether or not to let teachers carry. We need to have the debate now about whether or not we should require them to have some training. And there are folks in the House Republican caucus who are simply unwilling to take that step.
Yeah, definitely some Second Amendment purists, I would say. And what they see is sort of the slippery slope argument of, well, if you require them to have training, the next thing you'll do is require everyone who has a gun permit to be trained. And so they are really worried about applying any training requirements to anyone with a gun, because they don't want it to keep sort of going. Now, I do think there was probably some middle ground to be found this session. There were concerns in the House about the training being too extensive, too prescribed. But at some point, you know, they only had a couple weeks left and they were just like, nope, we don't have time to get into that sort of deep detail on that.
Beyond that that issue, there were some big education bills that were passed this session. We talked a little bit about one that didn't happen, which was teacher pay, which lawmakers made very clear from the outset they were not going to, or Republican lawmakers made clear from the outset that they were not going to deal with. But there were some big education bills that happened this session. One happened really fast, which was what's called Hold Harmless. So we went to a new statewide standardized test for Hoosier students last year. And as a lot of people expected, the scores dropped pretty significantly, maybe even a little worse than some people were hoping they would.
Yeah.
And because school funding, teacher pay raises, things like that, the letter grades that schools are assigned are all tied really intrinsically with those test scores. As soon as the scores came out, everybody agreed, okay, we're just not going to count those against you for a couple of school years.
Like, we're still going to give them out, but we're going to act like they don't exist.
Yeah, basically.
And so that bill passed very quickly. Similarly, a larger, sort of more permanent bill would decouple test scores. Right now, state law mandates that test scores of a teacher's kids be included in their evaluation, which is obviously how they decide whether they get a pay raise. So this now says they are not required. A local school district can still use them if they want. But so decoupling teacher evaluations from test scores permanently is a big win for teachers. They have been against that for the past, you know, 8-9 years when it's been put in. And Republicans, I think what we can say is there's been so many changes in the standardized testing that I think they've all lost faith in it. And so they're kind of like, well, if we don't believe in the test and what it's doing, then we probably shouldn't hold teachers to account for it.
And even more than that, we've seen teachers getting really frustrated. And we saw right before the session this huge rally, 15,000 teachers at the State House rallying for a variety of things. And this was one of them. And I think lawmakers are unwilling to do some things because they just don't think it's the right course to go down. But I think in part because of that huge uprising of teachers about wanting to see some changes in state law, I think this was one of the things that really brought lawmakers around. That was like, okay, they've been asking for this for a long time. And in part because of the volatility of the tests over the last decade, maybe this is one that we should go along with. And I think that was a case of we saw teachers rally at the State House, show up in large numbers and demand some things. And I think this is a direct result of that.
There were also some efforts to loosen regulations on public schools this session.
There's a bill that a lot of people are calling sort of the Freedom Bill. It basically says that your local school district can go through these hundreds and hundreds of regulations that are put on schools, and they can ask for the state board to waive them having to follow them. They have to have a specific goal, such as higher test scores or higher graduation rates, that kind of thing. There are some regulations they would not be allowed to waive, sort of health and safety regulations, you can imagine. But
as well as anything that's collectively bargained between the school district and the teachers' unions.
But we'll see if it works. To be very fair, we've had a number of regulatory flexibility bills in recent years. They have different names, and a lot of schools haven't gone along with that. So we'll see. Maybe a lot of schools will get on board and get a lot of these extra, you know, sort of tedious regulations that they have to fill out forms or provide specific training, that kind of thing, that they can get away from so that they can focus more closely on the classroom.
Just to circle back to teacher gun training, do you, given the sort of mild strife around it this session, do you think that we may circle back to that next year?
I mean, there's certainly folks in this, again, the Senate Republican caucus, who really, really want that bill to pass. And there's folks in the House Republican caucus who really don't. In a longer session, sometimes those sorts of things have more of a shot because there's just more time to maybe work out compromises or things like that. So I wouldn't be surprised to see it come up again. But as to its chances of passage, I really don't know.
And to address any teachers' concerns who might be at home right now and listening to this, teacher pay will come up next year because it's a budget year.
Well, look, let's be honest. 2 weeks ago, I would have said absolutely, but we don't know.
Right.
Because we are in a different world right now. We don't know what parts of our society will be actively running. I mean, we don't have schools open right now, so you can't really talk about raising teacher pay when you don't even know if we're going to finish school years and things like that. So I think it's going to be a wait and see a bit for now before they start locking in agendas for 2021.
Yeah, the very real possibility that we are looking at for the 2021 budget session is for the first time in more than a decade, a state budget that they cannot project growth for. Mm. That we're going to have to be talking, instead of the things about what are we going to spend our money on, is what are we going to have to cut?
Wow. We are talking about the 2020 legislative session, wrapping it up with Brandon Smith, our State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and Nikki Kelly from the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. There were a number of bills that specifically impacted Indianapolis, but before we get to that, was there anything else on the statewide level that we have not yet talked about?
I think we hit a lot of the big stuff, but it's important to note that with one exception, some of this Indianapolis stuff technically does apply statewide.
Of course.
Now, it was targeted at Indianapolis, mm-hmm. but some of the changes that they put into law or that they potentially put into law could have a ripple effect across the state, certainly.
Okay, and so among those bills that specifically impacted Indianapolis, one of them had to do with panhandling. Can we unpack that?
Yeah, so that's an example of one that while they really had Indianapolis in mind when they passed it, it technically applies to any city, any town in the state.
Of course.
I think everybody agrees that there is a panhandling problem in Indianapolis. Now, unpacking that is a lot more complicated because there is an intersection certainly with homelessness. And I think legislative leaders and lawmakers don't want to attack homeless people. But they believe that the panhandling problem in Indianapolis is related in part to a more coordinated effort of folks who aren't necessarily homeless but are doing this basically sort of to make a living of sorts. And that's what they're hoping that this new bill sort of addresses.
Yeah, it expands. Obviously, there were already some limits on panhandling statewide. It expands it to basically you can't panhandle within 50 feet of any financial transaction, and it defines financial transaction to include obviously a bank or things like that, but any parking meter, any business. So
any place where basically money changes hands.
Wow, that really limits things.
It really does. Right. And any public monument, it was definitely went after the monument there. Now, I will point out, this doesn't impact, you know, we've all seen homeless people sleeping on the streets. This doesn't impact that because it's not only panhandling, but it's aggressive panhandling.
Yeah.
So they have to meet certain things, like they have to follow you. They have to use profanity. They have to touch you, you know, things like that. They have to keep asking after you've said no. So literally just sitting there with your sign and not saying or doing anything, this doesn't impact that kind of panhandling.
And it certainly wouldn't impact, obviously, again, because it's panhandling. If you're just a homeless person who's on the street and not even asking for money, it obviously doesn't impact that. A big key to whether or not this will actually change things in Indianapolis is going to be enforcement. One, will they even be able to enforce it? Because there are constitutional issues. Indianapolis tried to pass a stricter panhandling ordinance a few years ago that was struck down in court. The ACLU of Indiana, who was part of that suit, is now saying that this new expansion of Indiana law runs into the same problem. There will probably be a legal battle, and so we'll see if that law even takes effect. And if it does take effect, how will Indianapolis enforce it? Because some of this, Nikki just pointed it out, it defines it as aggressive panhandling. A police officer is going to kind of have to see it happening in order to stop it from happening or to arrest the person or fine them or whatever the penalty is. So again, they are trying to address a problem that they see impacting tourism. We heard that a lot as that came up, is we've heard from folks who have conventions here that they don't want to come back because of the panhandling problem that they dealt with in downtown Indianapolis. Will it help that? There's a lot of things that sort of have to happen first before we know the answer.
Another one of the bills impacted Indigo quite a bit. What about that one?
Well,
yeah, that one was a second reading amendment tossed there at the very end of the session, maybe, I don't know, 8 or 9 days left. And
now this one would only have impacted Indianapolis.
Because there's a specific state statute that set up the red line ability. And so basically,
the dramatic public transportation.
It would have required, in state law already, Indigo was supposed to provide 10% of the funding for the program from outside sources, from philanthropy, that kind of thing. And they had not, to date, provided any. And so
They had started to set up the sort of mechanism for that, but they hadn't actually raised the funds yet.
So this basically would have put them on alert to have to do that pretty quickly, or they wouldn't be able to move forward with future expansion plans.
And so that was put forward by Senate Republicans, specifically a couple of them from Marion County, Mike Young and Aaron Freeman. But House Republicans were never quite as comfortable with that. And they kept trying to find a middle ground with the Senate, and I don't think they really – and then we talked about that Curtis Hill bill earlier and how Senate Republicans killed that one.
Sure.
So Senate Republicans killed that on the last night as they were wrapping up, and the Senate passed the Indigo bill, and the House could have, and they didn't. And some of us are wondering if there was a little bit of retribution in there.
Okay.
They didn't quite say it outright, but
yeah, they didn't say it outright. It was clear earlier in the day of the last session that that those two bills were being used as leverage against each other. You give us this, we'll give you that.
Yeah,
so
playing a game of chicken a little bit, and both sides kind of blinked.
Always fun when fireworks go off. Marijuana cases. Of course, there was news last fall about the Marion County prosecutor, the new Marion County prosecutor, saying that he would no longer prosecute cases of small possession in Marion County, which is Indianapolis, all Indianapolis. And so the state tried to get ahead of that as well and kind of undermine.
Yeah, I'm going to bring up Mike Young again in the Senate Republican caucus. He really didn't like that. And to be fair, he was not alone. There were other Senate Republicans who really didn't like Ryan Mears's just saying that policy out loud. I think there was a sentiment among some that, like, if he just hadn't announced it, if this was just something the office was doing, which, by the way, it already was. It was doing it under Ryan's predecessor, Terry Curry. Ryan made it a public sort of announcement. And there's a reason to do that. One, he was running to become the prosecutor in a private caucus. But also, I think it was sort of sending a message like, we don't think this should be a crime anymore. Now, there are folks at the State House who definitely aren't on board with that and aren't also on board with what Ryan Mears decided to publicly say. But Nikki used a phrase earlier that just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. And I think this might fall under that category a little bit. It made it through the Senate committee, Mike Young's committee, and he was really pushing hard for that. It barely made it through there. And we never saw it again, really. He just couldn't get enough of his caucus to back the concept as a whole, because there were a lot of folks, Republicans, who were uncomfortable with the idea of usurping a local prosecutor's authority that way.
Well, and also because it can go the other way.
I mean, there might
be prosecutors who say we're not going to prosecute gun crimes. Or, for instance, like you can go on state or school property with your gun and maybe they would say, well, we're not going to prosecute that. You know,
and there's a very real possibility at some point that we will have a Democratic attorney general again. And in that case, a Democrat who's in that office could have used this bill to go after exactly that sort of situation that maybe Republicans wouldn't want them to. So I think that was one where cooler heads prevailed and everybody took a look at the situation and said, listen, maybe we don't like this, but going after him, using the state law to go after him is probably a little too far.
And the pragmatic reasoning behind this, behind Ryan Mears' decision to do this, was that this is the most populous county in the state. And there are a number of things, the bigger fish to fry, I guess, in his view. And
he was looking at it as a resource issue, too.
Right.
Like, I don't want to expend the limited dollars that I have prosecuting these people, holding them in my jail, because jail overcrowding is a real problem, not just in Marion County, but across the state. And he saw this as a way to go, well, this alleviates some of my problems, and I don't think it's going to hurt the community.
Brandon Smith is our State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Thank you so much for joining us today and for stopping by every Friday afternoon throughout the session.
Always happy to do it.
Nikki Kelly is State Government and Politics reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Our podcast is wherever you get podcasts. Tomorrow, we have the Friday Pitch-In, where we catch up on some of what happened this week in Indiana. In the meantime, we're on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.